and welcome to another edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week, here come the fuzz. Yes, I'm well and truly nicked by the boys in blue, Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, the team behind Shaun of the Dead and now cop comic caper Hot Fuzz. If those talents weren't enough, we enter the spotless mind of French genius Michel Gondry, who's gone from fabulous pop videos to some of the most original-looking films. We contemplate suicide from the Golden Gate Bridge and review Diane Keaton's latest comedy. That's all to come on Film Weekly, the Observer's film podcast, with me, Jason Solomons. Let's start with a fuzz cast. Following collaborations on TV comedy Spaced and hit zombie rom-com Shaun of the Dead, actor Simon Pegg has co-written another comedy with director Edgar Wright. Hot Fuzz is the story of top cop Nick Angel, played by Pegg, who's transferred to a quiet country village. There, he's lumbered with Nick Frost for a partner and engaged in mundane tasks such as nabbing underage drinkers and capturing a swan. Slowly, however, Angel's suspicions are aroused by a series of grisly accidents, and soon he's swept up in a spiral of comic corruption that could lead all the way to the top.
I know what you're going to say, but the fact is, you've been making us all look bad.
I'm sorry, sir?
Of course, we all appreciate your efforts, but you've been rather letting the side down.
It's all about being a team player, Nicholas.
You can't be the Sheriff of London.
If we let you carry on running around town, you'll continue to be exceptional. And we can't have that. You'll put us all out of a job.
With respect, sir, you can't just make people disappear.
Yes, I can. I'm the chief inspector.
Hot Fuzz boasts as many good gags as it does fine comic actors. Paddy Considine, Jim Broadbent, Timothy Dalton, Billy Whitelaw, Lucy Punch, Adam Buxton. The cast list is one of the finest assembled since, well, Shaun of the Dead. Wright and Pegg have upped the jokes budget here, and barely a frame passes without a sly sight gag or a belly laugh. A mix of slapstick and verbal irony as the duo pay homage to all those action and buddy movies that are such a staple of American cinema, yet such a rarity here. Hot Fuzz is a rarity of its own, a slick, smart, funny comedy that sustains laughs and plot throughout its surprising two-hour runtime, and one that blends explosions, car chases and gunfire with very British understatement, a sort of Bad Boys 2 meets Heartbeat. It doesn't quite have the disarming sweetness which made Shaun of the Dead so likeable. Perhaps there are too many arcane film references and set-piece flourishes for any actual emotion to be involved, but it is cinematically ambitious, comically assured, and will certainly be another huge hit. Collared Simon and Edgar for Film Weekly the night before Hot Fuzz was released on an unsuspecting nation, getting a showcase treatment at the National Film Theatre. Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright, welcome to Film Weekly. We're sitting in the bowels of the National Film Theatre here because Hot Fuzz is getting the auteur treatment. You're on the big screen here at the National Film Theatre.
NFC One is a good screen as well.
It's the best, I think.
It's a good one.
It looks very good on there, I have to say. It looks unlike anything else because, it seems to me, I certainly haven't seen a British cop film, certainly not at the NFT. I've seen a British cop film since The Sweeney 2.
What about The Boys in Blue?
Well, The Boys in Blue. I thought we weren't allowed to mention that.
No, that's okay. It is the last one.
I thought that was lazy journalism, Simon, apparently.
I forbid Empire from mentioning it because during their reviews of Shaun of the Dead in both the cinema and the DVD review, they managed to mention Boys in Blue as an example of bad TV to film transfer.
I was about to say when you said Boys in Blue, I was going to say, yeah, but that's a comedy, which doesn't say much for our film, which is also a comedy.
That's the thing is that I'd always thought that there were just no British cop films and there hadn't been, you know, all of the British crime films are gangster films, and with a couple of notable exceptions, way, way, way too many of them.
I mean, there used to be sort of back in the sort of 40s when the Bobby was a kind of upstanding member of the
community. Blue Lamp.
The Blue Lamp, the Arsenal Stadium mystery. Leslie Banks was a marvellous policeman, but he wouldn't have the uniform on. Do you know why this is happening?
I think that's because the American police officer kind of... It's in a weird way, it's similar to the way that our horror industry was superseded, you know, that a sort of bigger, more extreme version appeared elsewhere, you know, in the same way that the more violent, more visceral horror movies kind of supplanted Hammer. Our Bobby, you know, became sort of outmoded by these sort of upgraded cops that we get in America.
Well, I mean, yeah, and it, you know, exactly like that in terms of like Hammer was kind of wiped out by, you know, George Romero and John Carpenter because like seeing kind of, you know, gothic castles and Dracula in a velour cape didn't kind of hold muster against Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the same way that like Zed cars can't really match up to Dirty Harry. So,
but it comes.
but it comes
down totally to the fact that for the most part, like obviously British police don't have guns. Obviously that is changing rapidly, but like, you know, 75% of officers don't have guns, and it's as simple as that. And like, really, like when we first pitched the idea to Working Title, the first thing Eric Fellner said was, "Are they uniformed?" And we said, "Yes." He said, "But they're so uncool." And I said, "That's exactly why it's going to be cool."
I mean, it is cool because it's funny, definitely. And it is, I actually say, sort of pound for pound, line for line, this is actually funnier than Shaun of the Dead.
Thank you very much.
That's good, right?
Yeah.
I think it is. I think there's more jokes in it, I think. And it's more concentrated even than Shaun, even though it's a little bit longer. It's probably denser comedically, which is a good thing. It doesn't sound good.
I was thinking, and this is the highest compliment I can pay, of Zucker Abrams and Zucker Airplane gag. Get no expense spared for cheap gags.
I saw your thing in The Observer where you picked Top Secret as your film, and I was very impressed by that because that's one of my favourites. In a way, what we were trying to do is do a comedy within a genre that's more like an immersion within that genre, and like, not to kind of like try and big ourselves up too much, but more in the kind of line of maybe what Tarantino does. Obviously ours is more funny than that, but it's the same kind of principle of like making a film about a genre that you love.
I remember being here doing a Q&A with you guys on Shaun of the Dead, and we were talking at that point, you know, you did the zombies and rom-com together there, and you were looking at that point for another genre on which to pin your jokes. Is that what it is? You've got these jokes there and you thought, well, what's the best way of telling the story? Or are you a team that's got these stories that just have to be told?
It's a couple of things. It was the fact that there were no British cop films, and it seemed, in a weird way, I suppose, like the films that we've done so far, and less so with Shaun and more so with this, but it's the kind of films that don't get made in this country.
It makes me laugh that you even kind of embodied the slacker for almost for a generation, Simon, because two less slack people, I've never met than you two. I mean,
we have our moments.
We have our moments of slackness. But we turn our moments of slackness into kind of into scripts.
Yes.
So we can watch, like, you know, like 10 Steven Seagal films in a row and actually call it research.
Yeah. I mean, is that what you literally do? Because I mean, so many of your shots reference other. I mean, you actually sit there watching DVDs when you were slack, in the slack days, sat there going, oh yes, I'll note that down and that will come back. Or is it just in there?
It was part of the process. I mean, the first thing we did was we realized we were going to have to kind of identify the lexicon of action films. It was like, okay, there's going to be an alphabet there that we want to learn and become fluent in. So we just watched as many films as possible, you know. And that was part of the thing. And we'd sit there studiously, particularly Edgar writes notes like a crazy man. Just any little line, anything, even stuff that would never be used. It was all part of like a greater mood board that we'd put together. And you know, it's kind of fun to watch a lot of films, but it's also quite hard work.
What are you, at home on the sofa with bags?
In the office.
Yeah, in the office and
are
stuff.
You in the office? That's what it's worth.
Well, it's too... Yeah, no, because the thing is, writing at home is a fucking disaster.
And, I don't know if you can say that on a podcast, but...
You can bleep it out.
On a fucking podcast.
Yay!
Helen Mirren fucking said it on the red carpet.
Nice. God bless
Mirren. She said, I'm the fucking queen. I'm going to win a fucking BAFTA tonight.
God save Helen Mirren.
No, we do it in the office. When we started writing Shaun of the Dead, we tried to do it at our respective flats every other day, and it was a disaster because too many distractions, too easy to make coffees and watch.
You don't want a coffee distracting you from Under Siege, do you?
What's really, really just fun is not necessarily about being like magpies and just half-inching things from other films. It's more just about completely immersing yourself, and that's totally what it is. It's just, and what's amazing is if you watch kind of, and a lot of the, you know, I'd say about 50% of the films we'd seen before, some I'd seen and I wanted to show to Simon, some I'd never seen and wanted to track down, and I used like a, you know, like a 6-month period to kind of like scour every like Amazon, Kim's Video, to find all these kind of ones on Region 1 and, you know, bootlegs that I'd never seen. And what's brilliant, like watching so many things in a row, and not even just the same things, like we would watch, you know, Out for Justice with Steven Seagal, followed by Passport to Pimlico, followed by Invasion USA, you know, just like really wide variety of films that were kind of like things that were in the genre, Agatha Christie films.
And you're looking for tone, you're looking for something that you can take the mickey
just
out of.
To learn it. People assume that a lot of what we do is simply kind of is recreating stuff, when I think what we really wanted to do was to know how to make one of these films.
Yeah, well, Hot Fuzz is very delicately constructed for a kind of anarchic and sort of quite mad comedy. It's very, the structure is very nice. I mean, that's why it's probably here at the NFT, because you have a symmetry and a organic.
It was a headache
whole.
At times just to make, because it is very sort of it's very complex, and you know, I mean Edgar and me are a sucker for a setup and a payoff, and you know, we like to pepper the screenplays with stuff for the audience to do. And when it came to editing it, when we started taking things out towards the end, you think, oh no, I had to take something out at the beginning. It was like a kind of house of cards kind of thing, wasn't it?
And you, yeah, you totally get into that thing where you kind of sometimes, if you have a running joke, maybe you've shot three versions of that joke, and then you think, you know what, we only need two, or you know what, forget the first one, just go with the second one. And that is really, and that's really interesting, because you can show it to a preview audience. There's one joke about like a monkey, a cuddly monkey, and the first one got a laugh, but the second one didn't. But the second one was kind of more crucial and couldn't be edited out, so we took the first one out and the second gets a bigger laugh. And it's like, it's as simple as that.
That's,
and it's
magic. Such, that's movie magic. It's crazy, right there. It is rather lovely as well that everyone seems to have turned up. We seem to be at the centre of the UK comic universe now with all these kind of fantastic people.
I mean, it's nice to be like, I mean, what we really like is directors and that have repertory companies, and like people like Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers and Tarantino have that sense of like a rep, in terms of that, you know, you'll get Bill Murray playing the lead in Rushmore, then Royal Tenenbaums is playing a supporting part, then the next film is the lead again. And I really like that sense of like, when you watch those films, you kind of want to see the same actors again, and you want to see who else is in it this time. So like, you see Royal Tenenbaums, like, oh, they got Gene Hackman in it this time, next one Jeff Goldblum's in it. I love that. I love that aspect. I love like Tarantino would be making films and he'd have his kind of like core cast, like Steve Buscemi and Samuel L. Jackson, but then it'd be somebody like, wow, you know, what's he going to do with David Carradine? And I love that aspect. And so,
it doesn't feel closed off either. It doesn't feel like it's some sort of
club,
exclusive club. It's like anybody can be part of it.
Is there anyone that you fancy? I mean, are there some old English actors you fancy kind of dusting off, you know, like resurrecting, like he did with John Travolta, let's say, in Pulp Fiction, and then with Carradine?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose in a way, that's what a lot of the people that we cast in this is, not only were they right for the parts, but people that we not only admired, but we wanted to see on the big screen again, like Timothy Dalton, Edward Woodward, Billy Whitelaw, Paul Freeman, like, you know, other actors.
Yeah, people that you kind of missed as actors.
Dalton was good. He's good in this, isn't he?
He's fantastic. And it's funny because we were all the time thinking of this character as being along the lines of a Timothy Dalton style person, and then kind of thought, you know, well, why don't we ask Timothy Dalton, you know?
By the time he got cast, like, we'd even started doing the storyboards, and we'd even drawn him like Timothy Dalton. I'm not sure I've ever told Timothy this, but like, the idea is that like, when Timothy Dalton has a moustache, it means he's bad. Prince Baron, although he turns to good in the end, but he starts bad.
Rocketeer.
The Rocketeer is,
and he resisted the touch when we mentioned it.
He wasn't into it.
Oh, do I have to? And we were kind of like, please. And we showed him the pictures, and you know, because it's Timothy Dalton.
Has he got a sort of a range of tashes, or are they all his own work?
He actually scribbled a moustache on his 10x8 to have a look at it, and he went, oh, okay.
He did his own like sort of Guess Who game. Yeah, like sort of did his own sort of tash design. I think it gives him special evil mojo when he's got his moustache.
And when he had it on, he, you know, as soon as it came through, it was just, you know, he was away.
You started out in TV as well, where, you know, space people will. You have still quite a huge fan base from that. Have you outgrown the little box now? Can you go back?
No, not necessarily. And it'd be silly to kind of say never say never, because if the third film,
say never say never.
Oh, it's good to say that.
Yeah. I know what you mean. It's like, it's silly to say that you'll never do something again.
Because when the next film flopperoos,
you know, TV is not something you go back to. TV is a medium in itself, and it's ripe for some great stuff. But and I'll let Edgar explain this, because I thought he made a really great comment about it the other day, in terms of the permanence of a film compared to the sort of ephemeral nature of television, which was.
Well, one of the reasons we started writing Shaun, and we had a chance to do a Third to Resist Space at the time, one of the reasons was, is it's, and it's funny and it's kind of ironic there, because like, that show kind of really built up a cult through DVD. It didn't really build up a cult through the TV, and sort of people maybe assumed that it was a bigger hit than it was. And like, the second season that we were like, worked so hard on for, I'm sounding so American,
I call it a season now.
I know, listen to me, Arkahim, gone all LA. But the second series, you know, it didn't rate very well at all. It got good reviews and stuff. And when you've worked on something that hard for a year, and then like 1.1 million people tune in for the first episode, you kind of think, fuck this. It's like sort of, I really just thought, I don't know if I can spend a whole another year of Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
It was Blood, Sweat, and Tears, wasn't it?
And it was. And it's weird because, you know, the second series of Space has never been repeated by Channel 4. They even refused to repeat it. And you kind of, when it gets to that, and I know similar things happened to, like, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, exactly the same thing happened. And you can't help but think, why bother? You know, let's do a film. And in a weird way, even though more people watch TV than watch films, it achieves a kind of permeance and a resonance around the world that, like, that we hadn't.
Well, we think you're filmmakers now. I mean, I think you are film star, and apart from Big Nothing,
it wasn't that bad.
You only got away with that one because you're nice.
I said he was really good in this. Wasn't your fault.
I think you're right. I think it's taken Hot Fuzz to cement that, perhaps, and I hope it. I mean, I don't want to be previous.
No, I think it will.
Some people kind of, they don't want to let you move on in a way. It's hard to kind of, and weirdly enough, I mean, talking about Big Nothing, I think Schwimmer's an example of that, in that people simply won't let him move on from Friends, you know, and he's kind of almost the price you pay for doing something as long as he did, which is why maybe he's trying to direct it now. But it, you know, at first with Sean, the perhaps the more negative reactions to it were just, oh, it's just a TV show on the screen, which I know I'm in it, but I say this as a fan of Edgar's, and or even before a friend, that's not a TV show, Shaun of the Dead. You know, it's shot in 2:35. It looks like a film, you know. And it felt like people were sort of saying, no, you're not allowed to do it now. You have to stay there. You have to be one thing. You can't be the other, you know.
But also, like, I mean, and I don't know whether it's the same. I don't think it's the same case in the States, but there is in this country a real sniffiness between the two industries. I remember when I was editing Spaced, I was in the post-production facility, and a guy who ran the facility came past and says, oh, what are you working on? And I said, oh, I'm doing a sitcom. He goes, I'm very sorry for you, and walked off. And I thought, fuck off.
That man had obviously never seen Up the Elephant and Round the Car.
He'd never seen Jim Davison in the dressing room.
No, I think he had seen it, and that's why he was saying so. Sorry for me.
Guys, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thanks, Jason.
That was great, thank you.
Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright there talking at the National Film Theatre before the Guardian interview last week. Still to come on Film Weekly, a chance to win the Hot Fuzz soundtrack and a T-shirt, an interview with Michel Gondry, and To Jump or Not to Jump, the grisly secrets of the Golden Gate Bridge. First, though, Diane Keaton is back on our screens in romantic comedy Because I Said So. Keaton plays the clinging single mother to three daughters, Lauren Graham, Piper Perabo, and the youngest unmarried caterer, Mandy Moore. Keaton, approaching her 60th birthday, is desperate to see her youngest find a happy relationship and begins vetting her dates through an internet site. She fixes her up with a wealthy architect played by Tom Everett Scott, but Mandy is also secretly dating musician Johnny, Gabrielle Macht, of whom her mother does not approve. I've loved Diane Keaton for years. Annie Hall, The Godfather, Reds, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, even Baby Boom. She's been an extraordinary presence in both comedy and drama. But if you can undo a career in one fell swoop, then Because I Said So nearly manages it. I wish I'd never seen it. It's like catching your grandparents having sex. Quite literally, as Keaton herself treats us to an orgasm scene. This, of course, is a women's picture, something Keaton's been specialising in since First Wives Club and Something's Got to Give. I know men and women can have different tastes, but I was baffled by almost every line and character in this. Keaton spends her time shrieking and suffocating her daughter, yet trying to be as lovable and kooky as her old image. Her character simply doesn't work. Mandy Moore screws up her nose a lot and goes ditzy over ice cream flavours, while mother and daughter seem to be endlessly shopping for shoes, eating cake and discussing orgasms. As for the men, Everett Scott is a bore who orders wine in Italian. Max's musician wears waistcoats and a jaunty hat to signify artistic fecklessness, yet he also single-handedly raises a son, called Lionel, denoting unspoken heartbreak in his past. After The Holiday and last week's music and lyrics, here's another film with a nauseating scene of a man and girl sitting at piano composing a spontaneous duet. Has the keyboard become Hollywood's new pottery wheel? In Heathers, director Michael Lehman once made a very smart movie about girls, but that was a long time ago, 1989 to be precise. He's since given us 40 Days and 40 Nights and The Truth About Cats and Dogs. He also made the notorious flop Hudson Hawk. Because I Said So out-rubbishes all of those and finishes in quite the most awful mush, with a cookery class of pensioners all kissing each other. La-di-da, as Annie Hall once said. Romance is also the theme of The Science of Sleep, the latest flight of fancy from France's Michel Gondry, writing and directing for the first time without the help of Charlie Kaufman, who penned his first two films, Human Nature and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Mexican actor Gael Garcia Bernal plays Stefan, a graphic artist with a thing for drawing spectacular disasters, who returns to a dull desk job in Paris after the death of his father. He meets Charlotte Gainsbourg's Stephanie, who's just moved into his apartment block, and while he dreams of falling in love with her, the pair strike up a stumbling real relationship based on their fanciful imaginations and appetites for making Blue Peter-type models out of loo roll and cotton wool. The Science of Sleep is certainly strange. Sometimes irritatingly quirky, it is ultimately inspired and affecting, a mood piece that leaves the viewer disorientated and a little sad, as if waking from a difficult dream. There are sequences of visual brilliance, galloping horses made of felt, cardboard car chases, a pop group made of men in pussycat costumes, cellophane seas and time machines made out of old Simon electronic games. Gondry references Godard, Breton and Éluard, as well as Warhol and Lou Reed. As one character says, randomness is very difficult to achieve because organisation always creeps back in. And you can feel the director trying to keep his plot, his narrative, in some sort of shape here. What I love is the way Gondry attempts to represent the chaos of the human heart, the mixed upness of love, the sheer luck of getting two souls to chime together, even for a brief moment.
So, basically, you're just walking into the apartment, and all of a sudden you discover that the pony can run, and you feel very excited, and ready, and action.
Damn it, Stefan, you've ruined my pony. Why did you do that?
Cut. What are you doing? No, you should be ecstatic about me. You should be, like, praising my engineering genius.
Of course, my handsome.
It may sometimes look like a collage of primary school children projects, or even just the long clip reel of a video artist. The soundtrack is typically breathy Franco-pop. But Gondry achieves something much more precious and ethereal here, an almost unidentifiable kaleidoscope of sensuality and emotions. I caught up with Michel Gondry on a snowy day the other week and asked him about what clearly must be his most personal project to date. Michel Gondry, welcome to Film Weekly. Thank you very much for coming on. Your new film, The Science of Sleep, is about the randomness of dreams, it seems to me, about many, many things in there. There's a whole world in there. But essentially, it seems to me about the randomness of love and the randomness of dreams. How would you go around pitching this film? It seems to me that's the hardest thing to do, pitching your stuff.
It's a journal about dreams. It's a journal using animation and real-life action to describe how dreams interact with real life, how you make some decision based on dreams and not necessarily the best decision, and obviously you dream, your dream are influenced by reality, what you've done in your life. So that was basically the subject. I wanted to write something very personal about dream and emotions.
People always think Eternal Sunshine is a very personal work, and many of your pop music videos seem to me quite personal, and they come from a very personal place inside you. But this one seems to me to be almost, I felt like I was intruding sometimes watching this.
Oh, no, please, welcome into my sick world. Yeah, it's very personal. I don't want to put my life in people's face, and I think I made it. It's, I guess it's funny at times, awfully entertaining enough that it's not only me, putting out my guts. But since it was the first time I was writing myself, I wanted to dig into some material I know, and obviously I know myself better than anybody else. So I met with Gael 1 year prior we started to shoot, and we talked about this character, about me, about Gael, about many things. Which makes it, when we started to shoot, we had so much in common by this friendship we created that he had a lot of freedom. He had so much freedom, he could do whatever he wanted and he would be the character.
But you're also, I gather you're still playing your music as well, aren't you? You're playing drums recently.
Yeah, 5 minutes ago in the hotel room for a TV show. No, I like to play the drums. I'm going to play with my favorite band of all time, which is called Booker T and MGs.
You're playing with Booker T and the MGs.
Yeah, I play with them for the soundtrack of my next movie, and we're gonna maybe do a record together.
Or Green Onions.
Yeah, well, we're gonna do Red Onions now.
Have you seen Björk recently?
I exchanged email and I had her on the phone like 2 days ago.
I always think if one person can get her back into film after Lars von Trier has said she never would.
No, I am sorry, damage has been done. But she did a movie with her boyfriend, but I don't think she would do a movie with me, not after Lars von Trier. He made some damage that's irreparable.
Michel, thank you for pushing on the science of film with the Science of Sleep. Thanks for coming on Film Weekly.
Thank you.
Michel Gondry there. Eric Steele's documentary The Bridge opens with spectacular footage of fog rolling in to swamp San Francisco's Golden Gate Suspension Bridge. There are seabirds, kite surfers and boats floating by. And then a human body jumps off the red platform of the bridge and plummets into the water, dead. The Golden Gate Bridge is the world's most popular suicide spot, and having read that fact in a New Yorker article, filmmaker Eric Steele set up two cameras to observe the bridge 24 hours a day for a whole year. The result is a film that features some of the most dramatic images in documentary history, as several people jump to their death in this spectacular setting. Of course, the film has a ghoulish element. We're watching death here, and I'm not convinced it brings us any closer to understanding suicide. However, it undoubtedly raises philosophical and ethical questions about us as viewers, the characters as victims, and the filmmaker himself as voyeur. I put some of those questions to Eric Steele when he visited the UK this week. First, I wanted to know why the Golden Gate Bridge was so popular for suicides.
It's a beautiful place. It's very dramatic. It's the railing is so incredibly easy to climb over. All you have to do is climb and let go. All those are definitely factors. And finally, I think the fact that what makes it unique is that it's public. It takes place in broad daylight, and there's a very good chance that you will be seen. And in the act of being seen, I think, comes this hope that maybe you'll be saved, that someone will grab you from the edge and pull you back. And, you know, that metaphor is so powerful. I can see why it's appealing.
Eric, you captured this amazing footage of people jumping to the death of the Golden Gate Bridge. How did you actually do that technically?
We had two sets of cameras, one on the north side of the bridge, one on the south side of the bridge. At each location, there were two cameras. Camera operator sat behind, you know, the camera and scanned across the bridge and watched people. And we were there every single day for an entire year from before the sun came up until after the sun went down. So, I mean, it's about 10,000 hours worth of tape.
Every time someone crosses that bridge, they look like they could be a jumper, yeah, in a way. Is that the feeling you got while you were looking at them? And it must have been a mix of dread and a thrill that you've got this amazing footage.
Really, not a day went by when we didn't think we were watching someone who was preparing to end their life, or a couple of people. And, you know, every time you saw someone walking alone, you know, your heart would move a little faster. Every time you saw them look over the edge or grab the cable, you know, you would start to feel different things. And, you know, it was always such an incredible relief when they would meet up with a friend or, you know, like walk off the bridge. You were like, oh, thank God. But, you know, some days, you know, the outcome wasn't so good. But you could never really tell just from watching them on the outside. I mean, it was always surprising. It was someone, you know, laughing on a cell phone, or, you know, a man riding his bicycle, or someone drinking from a carton of milk.
I was reminded of the Bruegel picture of the fall of Icarus. You know, these are fantastic, you know, this great life-death event is happening and people are just going about their lives.
Right. I mean, I was an art history major in college, and so it was an image that I was very, very aware of. And when someone jumps off the bridge, there's this tremendous splash, but it's tiny in the landscape. And the bridge is, you know, enormous, and these tankers are going by and cars are moving back and forth. And, you know, a boat comes out and recovers a body, but within, you know, seconds, things go back to the way they were. And, I mean, the world just moves by.
It's an incredible film. Congratulations on it. I don't know if I can say I enjoyed it, but it shocked me and my heart was in my mouth. It must have been an experience you felt live at least sort of, you know, 10 or 12 times.
Well, I mean, we felt it almost every day, but it's not meant to be an enjoyable movie in the same way that most movie-going experiences are. I mean, I wouldn't... Really, I wanted people to be haunted by these images and to sort of walk out of the theater and feel like they had to talk about it and had to communicate what they were feeling. And I think that's really been the response that we've gotten.
Well, thanks for doing that on Film Weekly today.
Thank you.
Eric Steele, director of The Bridge, which is now showing at the ICA. Now to this week's competition. I've got two copies of the Hot Fuzz soundtrack to give away, with two Hot Fuzz t-shirts and two special pads for proper police note-taking. All you have to do is tell me which Oscar winner makes an uncredited and unrecognisable cameo in Hot Fuzz, and what part do they play. Send your answers to podcasts@observer.co.uk, that's podcasts@observer.co.uk, and don't forget to include your address so we can post the loot to you. Last week, I offered you a commemorative edition of Zidane, a 21st century portrait, a film I consider to be the greatest film about football ever made, and indeed I proudly say so on the cover of the DVD. I asked you to differ and name your greatest football film of all time and explain why. The winning entry came from Guy Higgins of Kensal Rise in London, who says, "Jason, I can't wait to see the Zidane portrait. It sounds vastly different to my favourite football film, The Arsenal Stadium Mystery, which stars Leslie Banks as a copper sent to investigate the murder of a star player during a friendly at Highbury. The film features lots of chirpy cockneys, some great dialogue, and most of the 1938 Arsenal team going through a series of strenuous exercises involving medicine balls." Well done to you, Guy. That's it for this edition of Film Weekly. Next week, I'll be previewing the Oscars and talking to Danny Glover about African cinema, as well as meeting French cinema's international poster boy, Vincent Cassel, to discuss Monica Bellucci, La Haine, and working with George Clooney. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly is produced by Paul Noble. And until next week, we wish you happy viewing.